So we're back again from the studio, Kunstsatellit, on Nogatstrasse in Neukölln. We're listening to Pendulum music in the background, and I'm Kate Donovan, and I'm very happy to welcome Catherine Evans into the studio.
Thanks for inviting me in, Kate.
Oh, amazing. And you got a round of applause. Catherine Evans is an artist also based in Neukölln. I'm glad that we've managed to find lots of people from the Kiez. Stefan Heinbach earlier has kids in the same Kita as mine, and so does Catherine, so it's a very kind of familial feeling.
Yeah, it's nice.
So it's a rainy afternoon here in Berlin. We're sitting in front of the big shop window at Nogatstrasse. And Catherine Evans is an artist. And so we're going to talk a little bit about your work. I chose to start our set with Pendulum Music, which is a composition by Steve Reich from 1968, but what we heard there was a sort of a different rendition of it. But basically, for those of you who don't know this piece, the setup in a room would be like four speakers and four microphones hanging down, and then it depends how it's done, if it's just one person, but usually I think in this piece, there were four artists who each then took a microphone and pulled it back, and at the same time, then they let the microphones go.
Ah.
So as the microphones cross the speakers, it creates this feedback noise. So you, in the beginning, you hear this very clear differentiation, and then as the swing becomes narrower, it moves over,
intensifies somehow.
Yeah, well, yeah. It becomes more like a longer tone instead of in the beginning it says boom as it crosses, and then slowly it becomes this tone, and then obviously you have the four microphones, so there are these layers.
Yeah. It's beautiful. I recognize the oscillation in the tones, but I wouldn't have been able to describe at all how the artist has made it.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I guess, is, I don't know, I was just thinking of a little link to your upcoming piece.
Yeah, so my current work actually is based on the Foucault's pendulum. So speaking of another pendulum, and Foucault's pendulum, it's an incredibly beautiful instrument in its simplicity. I'll just give a little explanation for any listeners who might not be entirely familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a simple instrument that gave the first direct evidence of the Earth's rotation. And it's incredibly simple in that it's basically a weight that's suspended from a string that's swinging, and that's the pendulum. And then on the ground, there's some sort of measuring device. So this is a ring, usually with some sort of increments around the edge. And just using gravity, the instrument swings, and over time, because of the markers on the ring on the ground, you notice that the trajectory of how it's swinging is actually shifting. And this... So the pendulum is not moving, its trajectory is not, but the ring that's laid on the Earth is shifting. And so that's how they first proved that the Earth is actually rotating.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So.
And when was that?
Oh, I couldn't say. Maybe like 16th century, something like this.
Mm-hmm.
There were, it's actually something I'm really interested in at the moment, is like the early mechanical scientists. And around this 15th, 16th century, the early experiments that were carried out to prove these basic forces of the Earth. So not just the Earth rotating, but also like early tests with gravity and momentum and things like this. So like precursors to this instrument were, for example, very simple gestures like throwing stones off towers,
mm-hmm.
and seeing at the different speeds they might fall based on their size or the height of the tower and things like this. So, but I couldn't give an exact date.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think that's enough anyway to get an idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your, this, the, what's the title of your work?
So the work, it's called Die Erde, die Achse, or in English, the Earth, the Axis. And what I've done is it's a new sculptural installation, so brand new. And I've taken Foucault's pendulum as the basis for the installation. I've taken the basic elements of it. So if you look at a documentation of the work, you'll recognize immediately there's the pendulum element, which is a stone sort of that comes across very with a long pole behind it, but it then sort of like reaching towards the roof. And then the second element is a large circle on the ground, which is also like a rose pink colour. And so that's the two basic elements. But the installation that I present is completely non-functional and static. So it's really just using this as a basis. It's not, doesn't give us any measurements. And one side of the large circle on the ground is actually leaning on a larger rock as well. So it's also like, I think that in the work, this is an important gesture in that it kind of off balances what's usually actually in the original instrument, completely symmetrical and balanced. So it's also dissected and it's kind of pulled apart and reconfigured this way.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And that's in Neukölln.
Yeah, so the work, I developed it especially for 48 Stunden Neukölln, so for this weekend. And it's in the main exhibition of the festival. Like each year they have like a Hauptausstellung. And the main exhibition this year is in the Umspannwerk on Richardstrasse, or the old subway station. And interestingly, different to all previous years, the exhibition is only online this year. So mm-hmm. it was all launched last night.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good in that it means that it doesn't matter where anyone is in the world, but mm-hmm. everyone can have a look at it, at the work, online through the festival website.
And are you doing, because I know some places are doing these like virtual tours, something like that?
Yeah.
So are you doing that?
So there's actually, I'm really impressed with how many different ways the curators have thought about how people can experience work online. So they've produced a really nice exhibition video with all the works and with a kind of a bit of a poetic narrative over the top that goes through and spends time looking at all the works. Then there's also like a room plan where you can choose to look at specific works with a still, and then there's an audio with like a very short 3-minute interview with the artist.
Mm.
Then you can also, I think via Zoom, or I'm not sure which interface, you can join live tours, or have kind of like a silent avatar tour where a person can guide you through the room based on your instructions of where to go and everything, and that's also live.
Oh wow!
So they've really thought about a lot of different ways.
I mean, what I understood was like, because here at Werkstatt we usually would have open studios,
mm-hmm.
so there would have been the option for us to be here live online, and then people could join us and do, you know, a virtual studio mm-hmm. visit kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we decided to go for radio instead. But I wondered if that was also happening with the exhibition, that there is more like direct contact with the audience.
Yeah, I guess that's through these avatar kind of tours and the live tours, you're kind of like logging on, and what the curators or the guides are speaking in like real time. But an audience is not physically there in the space.
Yeah.
And I must admit, it's a strange feeling as well to produce a new work and be really itching to share it with everybody.
Yeah.
But then for physical visitors not to be there, so it's also, I have to shift my thinking as well.
Yeah. Well, because it also expands your audience in a way, because, you know, like you say, anybody with internet access can.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So also I'm really excited because Australian audiences, which is my background as an Australian artist living in Berlin, I've been able to share the work directly with them, and that doesn't happen when I'm usually exhibiting in Berlin. So
Should we play a song, maybe?
Sounds good.
So you brought some stuff. Should I play one of those?
Maybe let's start with the Mary Oker track.
Okay.
And she's a Berlin-based artist, and this track is called The Endlessness. So maybe that's a nice starting point for us.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we're back again. Oops. And I'm here in the studio with Catherine Evans. And we're talking about your new work that has been made, especially for 48 Hours, Neukölln. And you use rocks very often in your practice, in
That's
your
right.
sculptural and photographic work. And there's usually, they're not just any old rocks that you take. They're, you know, they have some sort of meaning or connection to a space. Tell us about the rocks in the new piece.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's two rocks in the piece. There's the large, and both have been collected locally. The large one, which part of the circle is leaning on, I selected because it's got this quite amazingly uncanny pink circle itself within the rock. So it's they're both granite rocks. And this pink sort of like seam of granite that runs through it in a way actually mirrors the circle that's in the piece. Then the piece of granite that's at the end of the pendulum is also collected locally. And I collected it from the construction site actually near here that I've been watching for quite a while now. I don't know, you probably know it as well. It's where they're building the new highway that intersects with Sonnenallee, just near here.
Yeah, I actually, if I bike my kids to school, I go past it.
So you're passing it all the time.
So I've, you know, been watching that almost daily for the last 3 years.
Yeah, well, it's been going for a really long time, and it's going to go for a much longer time still.
Yeah, and then it's going to be a whole different experience to cross.
Exactly. It's going to be a lot of noise pollution, and it's going to be a completely different.
Not to mention heavy metals.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I for the last while I've been watching the construction sites as well. So there's the one on across is at Sonnenallee, then I think Grenzallee somewhere, and one a bit closer along, sort of near the one of the intersections with Treptowerstrasse. And I think it's really fascinating, actually. So firstly, I'm watching construction sites because sometimes I'm also passing with my four-year-old son, who is at a stage where he absolutely loves construction diggers and all this sort of stuff. So standing and spending some time watching the machinery, I've also been watching how they're digging out the earth. So as part of this construction, they're building a huge tunnel. And I went past the other day and I actually could see where they're digging through seams of the earth, actually. I don't know how deep, but incredibly deep. There's also another part further along where they've filled up part of the excavation with water. So I'm not sure exactly what they're doing there, whether that's actually the tunnel being bored out there or not. But it looks really uncanny because the water's blue as well. It's somehow reflecting this light. But what's been really interesting for me is I see that as they're digging into the earth, they're actually finding different types of stones and been dragging them up and leaving them kind of like almost like they don't know what to do with them at the side of the construction site. For example, there's a really large one on Sonnenallee, which I've been completely in love with for a while. And what's interesting about these stones is that they're findlings. Or I didn't know until recently the English word for them, which is glacial erratics, which I think is a beautiful phrase.
Wow. Yeah.
And basically they're rocks that don't belong to this area at all, but they've actually been pushed into this area at the end of the last ice age. So Berlin, like geologically speaking, is kind of like sunken in a shifting swamp area. There's not like a hard rocky base here at all. But they are digging out these huge, hard, heavy granite stones that have been pushed here at about, I don't know, 27,000 years ago, if my rough estimate is anywhere near correct, I don't know. And yeah, I just find this really fascinating that we're pulling, kind of like digging the roots of the city deeper and deeper, and at the same time we're also digging back in time as a sort of this same gesture.
Mm.
And so that's where, from this construction site, I've taken a very small one of these stones, which I'm using at the base of the pendulum right now.
Amazing. Yeah. How do you find that out?
I don't know. I don't know.
But I mean, I guess that's, in any sort of very specific field, there's some areas of the world that I feel very blind in, and mm-hmm. rocks is one of them somehow. It's some, mm-hmm. something that I really love, but I feel like I don't know. And trees is another, actually. I'm terrible with different,
I'm surprised that you'd be terrible with trees, though, but you're a gardener as well.
Yeah, I know, but I think I have an understanding for a tree.
Yeah, okay, or an empathy as well, you could say. Yeah,
but I'm not very good at being able to tell different species.
Yeah, okay.
And even with plants, it doesn't come naturally. Like, it's hard work. So, just wondered, how do you do that with rocks? Like, how do you read a rock?
I don't know how I can answer that. I mean, I can tell that they've been recently excavated, because firstly they're covered in the dirt from the construction site, and they don't have smooth edges. They're not eroded at all by wind or rain or any elements at all. So I know that they've been recently put there. Then standing there watching in the construction site, I've seen them physically removing them as well. So. And then as for the knowing the rock type and that they don't belong to this area, I guess just a bit of reading and looking around on the interwebs as well.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no top secrets. I'm definitely not a geologist, so.
Yeah.
Just a curiosity, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But after this work that's being shown now this weekend, my next step with it is I want to start a new photo series where which I've taken the first photo for already, which is kind of the opposite gesture to the installation. So if you look at the installation, you see there's a really large circle leaning on a much smaller rock. And then for this first photo in the series, I've taken this, or I've entered the site where this big stone is on Sonnen Allee, and leaned a much smaller circle, also the same color, pink color, against it, and just documented this. So it's kind of like, as the gesture I want is to sort of start, a visual language for measuring different scales somehow. Mm-hmm. So physically, I'm putting different size rings against different size rocks, but then also I want it to somehow, as I develop the project, I want it to also be like how I see these construction workers digging through the earth, somehow to also be able to measure something about a depth of time or a speed of time or something like this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that these moments where I take my, in inverted commas, measuring device, of course, just as a metaphor, there's nothing accurate about it. I want this to be kind of somehow pausing that process for a moment so that we can look at it and kind of try to, estimate it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's time or size or weight or gravity, I don't know. But
yeah.
So,
I went past somewhere recently. I actually can't remember where it was, but it was in the last few days where they were cutting down into the road, and it was such a clear slice. Mm. It was amazing.
Yeah.
It was like cutting into a slice of cake or something, and where you could really see the layers.
Exactly. It makes when you see something like that, it's really like making time physical. Actually,
yeah,
you can actually see it, and and it becomes concrete,
and then have a different perspective of the city then, actually, to think about what's underneath it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Shall we play your next song?
Yeah, maybe that's a perfect point to play the next song, which is by the group Einstein. Oh, you'll have to help me with saying this, Kate. I'm getting tangled.
Einstürzende Neubauten.
Yeah, so which translates to English as collapsing new buildings. And this song is actually from a really good documentary called Berlin Babylon, which is actually about how Berlin was rebuilt after 1989, after the wall came down. So maybe let's start with that.
Yeah. Berlin, Babylon. It's from the documentary. I don't know what that track is actually called.
I think it's just the same title as the documentary.
Ah.
I think. I'm sure there's many more experts out there.
Yeah, I'm not one of them. So we're streaming online, collaboradio.de. We're broadcasting in the neighbourhood on 87.0 FM. And here we are in Nordgartstrasse with Catherine Evans talking about your new piece.
Yes.
So we didn't plan to talk about this, but you won the Neukölln Art Prize.
you trapped me, Kate.
Well, I didn't plan to. I don't know what happened to me just then, but yeah. You know, we're in Neukölln. It's 48 hours Neukölln, and that when was that?
Yeah, it was actually just on the cusp of COVID-19.
Yeah.
Because it was at Gallery im Saalbau, the exhibition, and it closed early because of quarantine starting.
Yeah.
So it was really
so it was March, February, March.
Yeah, something like this. Yeah.
Yeah. So two questions actually. One, you know, how does the new work connect to the old work?
Yeah. You could say that.
Maybe later on we can move on to like how have you been affected by the changes of COVID-19?
Yeah. I think this new work actually stems quite directly out of the work that was in Gallery im Saalbau. So the work had actually the same elements. Mm. It very, very simple work, again, with stones balanced this time, sort of defying gravity on the ends of pink metal poles. And this was a wall installation, and I've taken for the new work exactly the same materials, so this time different stones, different types of stones with their own story,
mm-hmm.
but also still using the elements of the pink metal poles and basically totally reconfigured them. So I think materially the work follows on quite, like, visually quite clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think it's also just a sort of a continuation of the same investigations, in that work was also kind of about scale too. So in the work I was making sort of a large scale wall installation of a much smaller constellation, which was the pattern of the moles on my own back. So something quite small and personal. And again, this new work, Die Erde, Die Achse, is the same. It's kind of like taking some very simple materials to try and invite people to think of forces and movements that are much, much larger than ourselves. So again, thinking things like gravity, the rotation of the earth, the mm-hmm. expansion of the universe, if I really want to get outrageously large.
Maybe let's go back to this corona question later, because I do have another question about scale.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, one of the big criticisms of the Anthropocene, excuse me, which is a suggested term for our current epoch, that mm-hmm. Human activity has had a geological impact on the planet. That one of the criticisms is that it puts scale into such, our human experience compared to this massive understanding of scale
mm-hmm.
Can feel depoliticizing.
Mm.
I actually personally don't agree with that. I feel like it doesn't, for me, it doesn't have that, I feel like it doesn't have that effect in the end. But mm-hmm. I was wondering how you...
You mean, would say the word again, you said
depoliticizing.
Depoliticizing.
So people maybe feel like their actions and their intentions don't have an effect because if they think about the scale of the universe or even the planet and you know what's happening, that one human doesn't really make a difference. So that's been one criticism of, like, you know, understanding scale in this way is that it's depoliticizing.
It's also an anti-climate argument as well, that then if you look at, like, the deepness of time, climate has changed before as well. So as well, this is kind of like where people can take that as grounds for not taking, being responsible.
So I suppose then my question would be, because with your work, it does deal with giving people a different understanding of scale, then, and how do you, I don't know actually how to formulate that question, but you know, I don't know whether to aim at you or, like, you thinking about your audience, but I guess in general, the human activity or impact, what does this sense of scale do?
I think, well, I can just answer, like, from my personal perspective, that when I am in a circumstance or I'm reading something that reminds me of how infinite the world is around us, and that our timeline here on Earth or our, like, little area of perception is so small, then I think, you know, that kind of perspective, I think it gives me a real sense of awe in the intricacies and the vastness of the world around us, and I find that really, like, that the poetics in that really powerful, because then there's a huge amount of respect in that, because we're actually just very small part of a much, much bigger picture. And so I think for me, it kind of, it helps me to feel a respect, and with that a responsibility too, because
it's a great answer.
So
because I mean, I hear that criticism a lot, and I can understand it in a way as well, but I, you know, when I think about, for example, watching shooting stars, or, you know, even just stargazing, looking at the stars at night, like, you have this, through that action, you have an expanded idea of your place on the planet, in the universe, whatever. And the effect that I feel when that happens is not that that I somehow don't have power. It's like you said, you're a part of this big system that is all shifting together and moving. And
And I think also what's really healthy with, from that perspective too, is that it's not human-centric as well. So I think that's also a really dangerous trap, where we think that we're the most complex and intelligent life form.
Yeah.
And I think this is where dangerous thinking really starts, actually. Yeah. And so when we're reminded of everything else and all these huge powers that, you know, we don't have any control over, then that's a really strong feeling of respect. And it kind of reminds us that, you know, we're part of a big network.
Yeah. And that is, you know, in response, it's also a very valid criticism of this whole concept of the Anthropocene, right?
Because exactly, because it's a human-centric term. I mean, that's what it means.
Exactly. So I guess Corona does that as well somehow, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Again, I mean, it shows you how vulnerable we are, actually. And, you know, speaking of the Anthropocene and changes to the Earth and everything, I mean, Corona and the frequency of pandemics, frequency of bushfires, frequency of extreme weather events, all these things, mass migration, everything, that's all the result of all this change and effect that's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's also a call to arms in a way that we have to really change what we're doing.
Yeah. And do you think, because, you know, some changes were kind of forced, like unwilling changes, let's say, like in terms of aeroplane travel, for example. And can you imagine that it will just go back to normal?
It's really hard to say. It's a really good question. I actually really hope that it doesn't all go back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
I think as difficult as the circumstances have been for everyone, and also really scary, like we're talking about actually real danger here, like it's very dangerous for a lot of people and there's been a lot of fatalities and everything, as serious as all these things are, it's actually I see it also as a really good opportunity to actually try and change the world we live in. So one of the outcomes of corona, I think, is it's really exaggerated, for example, the gap between richer and poorer people, who have access to healthcare, who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
The effects have been really divided on economic lines. And I would actually draw this route back down to the problem of capitalism.
Yeah.
And the fact that big business actually is almost more powerful than politics today. And with shutting everything down, I kind of really hope that things don't go back the same line and that we do see changes, but whether that's going to happen or not, or I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think there's also, it's created desperation for a lot of people. And then, you know, not always the best decisions are made out of desperation.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you don't have, well, there often isn't a choice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. We're dealing with real issues here. I mean, you and I, we're in a lucky position. We're sitting here safe inside, but there's a lot of people who aren't as well, and it's it's difficult.
Yeah. Did we? We were talking earlier very briefly about gentrification in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
What did you want to say about that? Oh, was it her? Did we talk? We did.
Did we?
Maybe I just had that in my mind when we were talking about like construction sites. Then I was thinking about like, I guess because I was thinking of that area near Böhmischer Platz, where they're building those big fancy. Isn't it?
You mean the micro apartments? Yeah. On the corner of Niemetzstrasse and Braunschweigerstrasse. Yeah. But I mean,
maybe when we were talking about construction sites in terms of the motorway, then I also had that in my mind. I think that's why.
Yeah. I mean, it's happening at a faster and faster rate. So
it's all connected anyway, I guess.
Exactly.
Should I play something else?
I don't know. What would you? There was that one other track I brought, but I don't know. I don't know if we want to. What you think? But it's the
Powers of Ten.
Exactly. It's like it. But it's a narrative piece from this. It's an old video from the 1970s.
That's not. Oh no, that's just.
Dealing exactly with scale.
Yeah.
So it says in the description that it deals with the relative size of things in the universe and the effect of adding another zero.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's have a listen to that. Powers of Ten.
The picnic near the lakeside in Chicago is the start of a lazy afternoon, early 1 October. We begin with a scene 1 meter wide, which we view from just 1 meter away. Now, every 10 seconds, we will look from 10 times farther away, and our field of view will be 10 times wider. This square is 10 meters wide, and in 10 seconds, the next square will be 10 times as wide. Our picture will center on the picnickers, even after they've been lost to sight. 100 meters wide. The distance a man can run in 10 seconds. Cars crowd the highway. Powerboats lie at their docks. The colorful bleachers are Soldiers Field. This square is a kilometer wide, 1,000 meters. The distance a racing car can travel in 10 seconds. We see the great city on the lake shore. 10 to the fourth meters, 10 kilometers. The distance a supersonic airplane can travel in 10 seconds. We see first the rounded end of Lake Michigan, then the whole Great Lake. 10 to the fifth meters, the distance an orbiting satellite covers in 10 seconds. Long parades of clouds, the day's weather in the Middle West. 10 to the sixth, a one with six zeros, a million meters. Soon the Earth will show as a solid sphere. We are able to see the whole Earth now, just over a minute along the journey. The Earth diminishes into the distance, but those background stars are so much farther away that they do not yet appear to move. A line extends at the true speed of light. In 1 second, it half crosses the tilted orbit of the moon. Now we mark a small part of the path in which the Earth moves about the sun. Now the orbital paths of the neighbor planets, Venus and Mars, then Mercury. Entering our field of view is the glowing center of our solar system, the sun, followed by the massive outer planets, swinging wide in their big orbits. That odd orbit belongs to Pluto. A fringe of a myriad comets too faint to see completes the solar system. Ten to the 14th. As the solar system shrinks to one bright point in the distance, our sun is plainly now only one among the stars. Looking back from here, we note four southern constellations, still much as they appear from the far side of the Earth. This square is 10 to the 16th meters, one light year, not yet out to the next star. Our last 10-second step took us 10 light years further. The next will be 100. Our perspective changes so much in each step now that even the background stars will appear to converge. At last, we pass the bright star Arcturus and some stars of the Dipper. Normal but quite unfamiliar stars and clouds of gas surround us as we traverse the Milky Way galaxy. Giant steps carry us into the outskirts of the galaxy. And as we pull away, we begin to see the great flat spiral facing us. The time and path we chose to leave Chicago has brought us out of the galaxy along a course nearly perpendicular to its disk. The two little satellite galaxies of our own are the Clouds of Magellan. 10 to the 22nd power, a million light years. Groups of galaxies bring a new level of structure to the scene. Glowing points are no longer single stars, but whole galaxies of stars seen as one. We pass the big Virgo cluster of galaxies among many others, 100 million light years out. As we approach the limit of our vision, we pause to start back home. This lonely scene, the galaxies like dust, is what most of space looks like. This emptiness is normal. The richness of our own neighborhood is the exception. The trip back to the picnic on the lakefront will be a sped-up version, reducing the distance to the Earth's surface by 1 power of 10 every 2 seconds. In each 2 seconds, we'll appear to cover 90% of the remaining distance back to Earth. Notice the alternation between great activity and relative inactivity, a rhythm that will continue all the way into our next goal, a proton in the nucleus of a carbon atom beneath the skin on the hand of the sleeping man at the picnic. Ten to the ninth meters, 10 to the eighth, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We are back at our starting point. We slow up at 1 meter, 10 to the 0 power. Now we reduce the distance to our final destination by 90% every 10 seconds, each step much smaller than the one before. At 10 to the minus 2, 1/100th of a meter, 1 centimeter, we approach the surface of the hand. In a few seconds, we'll be entering the skin, crossing layer after layer from the outermost dead cells into a tiny blood vessel within. Skin layers vanish in turn. An outer layer of cells, felty collagen. The capillary containing red blood cells and a roughly lymphocyte. We enter the white cell. Among its vital organelles, the porous wall of the cell nucleus appears. The nucleus within holds the heredity of the man in the coiled coils of DNA. As we close in, we come to the double helix itself, a molecule like a long twisted ladder whose rungs of paired bases spell out twice, in an alphabet of 4 letters, the words of the powerful genetic message. At the atomic scale, the interplay of form and motion becomes more visible. We focus on one commonplace group of 3 hydrogen atoms bonded by electrical forces to a carbon atom. 4 electrons make up the outer shell of the carbon itself. They appear in quantum motion as a swarm of shimmering points. At 10 to the minus 10 meters, 1 angstrom, we find ourselves right among those outer electrons. Now we come upon the 2 inner electrons held in a tighter swarm. As we draw toward the atom's attracting center, we enter upon a vast inner space. At last, the carbon nucleus. So massive and so small. This carbon nucleus is made up of 6 protons and 6 neutrons. We are in the domain of universal modules. There are protons and neutrons in every nucleus, electrons in every atom, atoms bonded into every molecule out to the farthest galaxy. As a single proton fills our scene, we reach the edge of present understanding. Are these some quarks in intense interaction? Our journey has taken us through 40 powers of 10. If now the field is 1 unit, then when we saw many clusters of galaxies together, it was 10 to the 40th, or 1 and 40 zeros.
We have cling film on the microphone, FYI.
And I keep fumbling it.
it's a Corona microphone. Okay, that was Powers of 10 from 1977. I highly recommend looking at the video as well. You get a good impression from only the audio, but obviously the video zooms out and then back in again, and then further in.
That's right.
So we're coming to the end now of our session with Catherine Evans. Can you remind us how to see your work?
Absolutely. It's part of 48 Stunden Neukern's main exhibition, which is called Collapse, and you can visit it live through the festival website up until 7 p.m. tomorrow, Sunday the 21st of June, in the evening. The exhibition is a physical exhibition, but it's online. It's exhibited online. Just very quickly, if anyone's walking down Richardstrasse, the building, and you want to look at the outside of the building, it's incredibly fascinating old architecture. And above the door, that Richardstrasse 20, above the door there's a half circle window. And it's behind this window that my new work, Die Erde, die Achse, is installed.
But you can't see it through the window.
Yeah, no, you can't. But just so you can see the architectural elements, which you'll see when you look at it online.
Yeah, yeah, nice.
There's a nice relationship between the circle of the work and the window.
Yeah. And your website is catherineevans.com.au.
Correct.
Catherine with a C.
That's right.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you so much for the invite. It's really nice to chat.
Yeah. We'll play out with maybe you can hear in the background, Sten is warming up for his uncontrolled monologue. Before we move over to that, I would just like to play one piece from Anna Dal-Aramayek's album called Nanocosmos, since we were talking about scale. It's an amazing album. I highly recommend it. And she deals with, she makes compositions out of, let's say, micro sounds. So it could be the sounds of vines or woodlice or various things. So I'll play one called Pixel Springtail Promenade. Thank you.